My name is William Darling, number 32929. I represent the father in this case, and the attorney who represents the mother has deferred his time to me to argue today. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Two,
yes. In a DNA case, of course, the most important consideration is the welfare of the children, but that's not the only consideration. There are a number of other considerations that have to be taken into account. There's a strong public policy that the welfare of the children is met by keeping them with their parents, if possible. There is a strong policy that the parents should be helped by means of a treatment plan to correct their deficiencies in their parenting methods or to correct the deficiencies in their own lives and their own lifestyles. There is also a strong public policy that children may not be taken away from their parents without good cause and due process. The two basic questions in this case are, as I see it, whether the statute requiring that there be a timely adjudication in the case is optional or whether it really needs to be met, because in this case it was not met.
Mr. Darling, are you arguing that there was a failure to adjudicate, or are you saying that the adjudication was made but it's invalid?
Well, I say that there was not an adjudication made within the initial 12-month period, and when the court determined that it should have made an adjudication, it entered an order that said that the adjudication had happened at a prior hearing, but at that prior hearing, there really wasn't an adjudication, and the parents were not notified that that would have been an adjudication.
Did you certify the transcript from that prior hearing as part of the appellate record?
The prior hearing...
You're referring to the August 10th or 12th hearing, right?
Right, yes.
Okay. Did you include... No. Did you give us the transcript of that hearing?
No, I don't believe we did.
And how can we infer that the judge did something wrong if you don't give us a transcript to show it?
Well, I think from the judge's order, where he said that it had occurred previously, he was saying that the original stipulation that the parents made to defer adjudication, that the routine hearing at that during the August time frame, the adjudication could have been made at that time. Okay. The second question that I see here is that how should courts treat stipulations that are made by the parties where it turns out later that the stipulation is not possible to be implemented?
But let's stay with the first stipulation for a minute.
Okay.
Let's assume, with respect to your colleagues, that we agree with you. What relief are the parents entitled to, in your mind, with respect to the 208 stipulation?
Stipulation, the case law says the stipulation, I mean that the adjudication is necessary before you can move on to termination.
Okay, so what you want us is to set aside the termination and remand for the lower court to hold a hearing on the two children that are who are addressed in the 208 stipulation.
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. In that first stipulation, that the respondents say that upon a showing, that there has to be a showing that there has been a failure on their part of the treatment plans, and that if there is an allegation that they did not fulfill their treatment plans, the court shall conduct a hearing, find an adjudication of dependency and neglect, and make findings related thereto against the respondent based upon the admission entered. There was never such a hearing. That's really one of the things that we're talking about here, is that the court said it was the August 28th hearing, but if you look at the notice of that hearing, it was only a routine status hearing, and there was no notice that in fact would be a hearing for an adjudication. And without the adjudication, there can't be a termination. Now, in this case, the case had gone on for a number of months beyond the 12-month period without an adjudication. the parents were succeeding at their treatment plans. There was a date scheduled where the third child would be brought home, and everybody was looking toward success in this case, as there are in a number of these cases. Some cases are not successful, and some the parents are successful in their treatment plans. The parents both slipped up, and then the department wanted to file an amended petition. They took the children, including the third child who had been born during the pendency of this proceeding, and we were, and on behalf of the parents, we had asked for a jury trial. The jury trial was scheduled, and we were moving towards it, and a couple of weeks before the jury trial, we entered into a second stipulation. And the second stipulation was that, in essence, the parents would undergo a psychological evaluation and be given a new treatment plan. They would be given a second chance, and that they would be given a reasonable opportunity to meet the requirements of the new treatment plan, and that they would not be faced with a termination request or a termination motion by the department unless they violated their treatment plan in some way in the future. That never happened. Now, what they gave up in return for that is they stipulated that one of the things in the amended petition was correct, and they also gave up their right to a jury trial. They stipulated that there was an unsafe environment, which is, yes.
And that's the first time that there was an adjudication in your view.
Well, that wasn't an adjudication, I don't think. But if that is treated as an adjudication, that was the first adjudication that there was. Okay. They went to the psychologist and were evaluated, and the psychologist's report unfortunately came back saying that it would be very difficult for a treatment plan to be written for them. But more importantly, at the trial and termination hearing in this case, it came out that that psychologist did not write treatment plans for people, and that the department knew that, and that the department did not tell him that part of his job in the evaluation was to write a treatment plan. Now, in light of that, the court's initial order, I think it was the order of May 11th, said that, well, the department and the parents should meet to see if they could work out a treatment plan in line with the psychologist's reports. Unfortunately, Mr. Vinn, my colleague who represented the mother, had a heart attack, had heart surgery, and by the time he was back and able to continue and pick up the case, the department and the GAL had changed their mind and said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to meet with you. We're not going to try and work out a treatment plan. We're going to go for termination. Even though there's not been a new violation, we're going to go for termination. And in our view, if the treatment plan could not have been worked out, could not have been implemented because of what the psychologist did, we should have been put back to where we were, to where the parents still had the right to the jury trial, and because that's what they gave up, and they should have been able to take back the stipulation that they made, stipulating to the one matter.
The second.
So again, a parallel question to what I asked you before. So with respect to the second stipulation, you want the parents put back to the point where they had announced an intent to dispute dependency and neglect and ask for a jury trial on that issue.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And the children have been outside the home now.
They've been outside the home since, I believe it's the fall of 2000. I don't remember if it's 2000. I think it's 2010. I think it's 2009, as a matter of fact. But that year escapes me right now. They've been out of the home a long time. And I think that's particularly difficult in the case of the youngest child, because The youngest child was not even alive when the original allegations that started this case happened. And the only thing that happened during his lifetime was the slip-up where the father and the mother both had a positive alcohol test, and that he was then brought into the case. But that's the only thing that had happened with respect to either of them. And there was no showing that either of those slip-ups caused any violence or caused any problem in the home. Well,
not concerning.
Well, during the period of time when the department determined to take the children away and file the amended petition, there had been only a positive alcohol test on behalf of both the mother and the father. There was also an allegation by the department that the father had tried to mask the test. The subsequent positive drug and alcohol tests, or failure to come in and do the testing, happened after the parents found out, after the children had been taken away from them, and after they found out that the department was going to move for termination, and that the move, and they felt that the move for termination was an unfair treatment of them because the department had agreed not to move for termination unless there were new violations. And at that point, our contention was that there had not been any new violations. New violations happened after they were already told that their right to their children would be terminated.
That a treatment plan cannot be designed for these parents that will get them fit within a reasonable period of time.
Well,
should you then proceed?
Well, if I understand your question, it's really a two-part question. One is, you know, was that true? And I think that the psychologist's report said that it would be difficult. But that was just one person. There were other people that said that they were succeeding at their plan. And in fact, the department had been fairly laudatory of their efforts prior to.
And children.
Yes.
All the children.
Yes. And I think the second part of your question was that once a psychologist said a treatment plan cannot be written, doesn't that justify going directly to termination? And I don't think it does because of the stipulation that had been in effect. And the stipulation that had been bargained for, where both sides had gotten something and both sides had given something, and therefore the parents should be allowed the jury trial that they were entitled to before the stipulation. And I think I just have 2 minutes left. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Starr. It's my honor to serve as the Archuleta County Attorney. My bar number is 27641. Seated at council table with me is the Deputy County Attorney, Mr. Robert Kern, whose bar number is 42694, though we don't anticipate him addressing the court today. I think I'll have plenty of time. I'd like to cover four quick topics, if I may. The first one is with respect to the standard, and that is that the record before this court does not reflect any error that undermined the basic fairness of the trial as to cast a doubt on the reliability of the trial court's judgment. The trial court, and the effect and the weight of the evidence, as well as the inferences and conclusions, are soundly within discretion of the trial court, and therefore it's well settled that the trial court will not be disturbed on review if it is supported by the record. And of course, it's our position that there's ample support in the record for the trial court's determination. Mr. Darling ably talked about all of the rights to be considered. The fact is, the case law, such as a petition of JDK, suggests and tells us that the parental rights must yield to the interests and welfare of the child. And we are here today, as we were in January, because of the best interests of these children.
The problem prior to the trial, the problem that's being raised, these stipulations that were made well prior to trial?
With all due respect, I don't see a problem. I think the trial court handled things correctly. I think there, you know, every trial lawyer that I've ever known that comes through a successful trial wishes, can look back and wish that the water weren't quite so muddy here or there. But the trial court, Judge Lyman ably guided this matter through to a conclusion that serves the best interests of the children.
About protecting the rights of parents.
Well, I think he gave the parents, he protected the parents' rights to due process. I think if you look at the case law on that, I'm sure he protected their interests. They had notice and they had substantive rights that were protected. It's the children's rights, though, that are paramount to the parents' rights. And that's what ultimately guided, I think, the trial court in this matter, as well it should. And I respectfully suggest, as well it should guide this court today.
Did the parents have a hearing on the adjudication of the first two children?
There was not that I can't tell this court that there was an adjudication hearing.
Did the trial court make a specific adjudication as to those children, or did the trial court simply say that it had kind of impliedly happened along the way?
I think the trial court made a specific finding that it had occurred, for instance, in the August 18th, 2009, when there continued the treatment plans, and respondents' counsel, the appellants' counsel, both of them agreed with that, when they continued the children's placement, again, without objection, and when they continued jurisdiction, all without the objection of the parties. So the court, through its actions, and not via a specific written order, the court, through its actions, sustained the petition. And I might, if I'm not mistaken, Judge Webb, it was your concurrence, or you concurred with the NDV case, which held that you don't have to have that specific order. It's not jurisdictional. That what the trial court did in NDV is essentially the same thing as what happened here. It's not ideal.
In the September 20, 2010 order, the court says, quote, "It does not appear that the children were formally adjudicated," close quote. Why doesn't that end the inquiry and require a remand, as your adversary suggests?
For several reasons. As I've stated, because what the court says is there was never a written order, but there was an adjudication by practice, much like in the NDV case. And the second reason why that doesn't end the inquiry, and a very important reason, is they never raised an objection to that. It wasn't until 3 weeks after the termination hearing that the appellants bring forth this, oh, there was no adjudication.
So you're saying they can waive their right to an adjudication by silence?
Absolutely.
Is there any case law that supports that?
I think that NDT would support that.
Okay.
And I think if I want to move on, because I don't want to get beat up too bad, but I think that the 920 order, the court also confirmed that the parties acted, the parties meaning the respondents mostly, they acted as if an adjudication had been entered and a disposition occurred.
No, you wouldn't do the treatment plan until it had been adjudicated.
And they approved the treatment plan.
And you had a treatment plan.
Yeah, and we've had one.
Well, but you had one after the stipulation, or I don't
point taken.
When the first stipulation occurred. But you had a treatment plan that apparently was successful.
I would not.
Because the children were returned home. I mean, that's some evidence that the treatment plan was successful, or at least was progressing.
I will accept progressing, but I will respectfully decline to go as far as successful. Ma'am, if we would like to talk for a second, or a couple minutes, about the fact that the trial court correctly dealt with the February 2nd, 2010 stipulation, and the appellees were afforded multiple opportunities to succeed, which opportunities they have continued to squander. And here, again, the case law, like I think it's People XRL GRNM, tells us that it's the parent's responsibility to secure compliance with and success of a treatment plan. And this is also where I would enter into the theory of the doctrine of implied error in talking about the stipulation. It is the respondent's counsel, the appellant's counsel, that failed to carry out any due diligence. Why couldn't they have picked up the phone and called Dr. Cotta George and said, hey, we've got this stipulation, and it's our understanding you're going to do this because I'm waiving a bunch of rights, and I don't want to waive my client's rights unless I confirm what you're doing. They asked the court. They didn't do that, but yet they still asked the court to adopt the stipulation. And not only did they ask the court to adopt the stipulation, but it was not written in a vacuum. They participated in the drafting and the language of the stipulation.
Does the record indicate which side picked Dr. Cottager?
I don't know, Judge Webb. If the record...
Does the record show us if the department had previously used him in other cases?
I don't know if the record shows that.
Okay.
But I suspect in Dr. Cottager's testimony, as I stand here today, I can't tell you for sure what the record shows on that. I might refer you to the Guardian Ad Litem's brief. She did an excellent job in reciting the facts. And then finally, not only did they participate in drafting the stipulation, not do the due diligence in contacting Cotta George, not only did they ask the court to approve the stipulation, but then they participated with Cotta George. They sent their clients there to meet him, and when they met with him, they didn't say, hey, it's our understanding you're going to prepare a treatment plan, right? They let that go. And because they're also joined in asking the court to approve that stipulation, under the doctrine of invited error, they cannot now come back and seek redress from that.
Why aren't they entitled, as opposed to enforcing the stipulation for the reasons you said, why aren't they entitled to be put back to square one, as your adversary argues? Because it seems to me applying a contract analysis to the stipulation, whatever consideration was supposed to flow to them didn't, and the consideration that they gave to the department is still in the case.
A couple responses to that, if I may. The first, just went right out of my head.
Well, that's okay. Let me help you. They gave up a demand for a jury trial, and they conceded that the child's environment was dangerous, whatever the statutory word is.
And they got their consideration.
What consideration did they get?
The stipulation.
Okay, it wasn't enforceable.
Why not?
Because the doctor didn't give them a treatment plan, and the department didn't wait for them to slip up, to use your counsel's words, under the new treatment plan. So what did they get out of the stipulation?
They got a stipulation. They got more time. There's a couple of answers to your question. I have three answers to your question now that it comes back to me. The first reason why I would respectfully suggest the court doesn't return them to the date of the stipulation is that would not only be contrary to the best interests of these children, it would wreak severe damage to these children, is what the testimony and the record would suggest. The second thing is, and their lack of full knowledge, which is due to their failure to exercise due diligence, is no grounds for relief. And that's such black letter law that I find that at 73 Amjur 2nd, stipulations 13.
So you're saying it was the parent's obligation to make sure that the stipulation was implemented, even with respect to those responsible fell to the county?
Well, I don't think there were responsibilities that fell to the county that the county didn't perform. But I think it is.
Well, clearly the agreement calls for a new treatment plan.
No, the agreement calls. The agreement calls for a new treatment plan.
And it calls for them to start out at ground zero on that treatment plan. And the county is required to participate in the creation of that treatment plan.
Let me take a different swing at this, if I may. First of all, I would refer the court back to Judge Lyman's, I think, September 20th or 28th of 2010 decision, where he addresses the treatment plan and he cites the stipulation, and he cites a couple of cases, two cases in there that I think should be dispositive of the issue. But trying to move forward with an answer to your question, what Dr. Cottager said and what he testified to was that a treatment plan could not be prepared within a reasonable time. So is not that, at that point, termination, under the statute, at that point, termination becomes the treatment plan. So I would respectfully suggest that in moving towards termination, we were performing the duties of the stipulation. We were pursuing the treatment plan that was suggested, the only treatment plan left available to us as a result of the good doctor's testimony.
Trial court ever found that a treatment plan cannot be designed for these parents?
I believe that it did. I cannot cite you to page and line. I'm sorry.
How would that finding stand vis-a-vis the children being returned by the county to the parents during the first treatment plan?
Well, I think what I would say in response to that is that you can't view these cases in one moment. You have to view these cases, and the trial court, there's case law out there, so the trial court has to look at these over the long run and over the time. And the way you reconcile that is you say, the county tried. The county did give these respondent parents due process. We tried to put the kids back there, but it just wasn't successful. So we tried to get them to a psychologist that would come up with a treatment plan.
Did the county ever tell the psychologist that he was obligated under the STIP to come up with a treatment plan?
I do not know the answer to that question. I think that Fred Failia, a former county employee, I believe that he testified that he did not tell that to Dr. Cotta-George. I believe he did testify. I want to step back from making a representation, and I would refer you to the record and to the Guardian's recitation. To the best of my understandings, I believe Fred Failia's testimony was that he provided Dr. Cotta-George with a copy of the stipulation. But please look at the record for that one. I've got a minute 30. There's one point I'd like to bring out with all due respect to Mr. Darling, who's done a very able job in arguing this case. There's some inconsistency in the brief of the appellants. For instance, on page 12, with respect to the stipulation we've been talking about, Mr. Darling, at the final sentence on that page 12, he admits that there was no repudiation by the county of the stipulation. But then on subsequent pages, like 15 and 17, he argues that the county repudiated that stipulation. I would simply like the court to be aware of that seeming inconsistency. And if I may, with that, I would simply, if there's no other questions, I would tell the court that these proceedings were conducted with due regard for the respondent parents' rights. They were conducted in conformity with the statutes and with the appropriate focus on the best interest of the children. And we ask that you affirm the trial court. Thank you for your time. You're the judge.
You say in the record it's clear that remaining this back and having any further proceedings would be very damaging to the children.
Yes.
Can you give me some idea where that is in the record?
Absolutely. Read any two paragraphs of Dr. Cotta-George's report. He is clearly the most qualified of the experts that testified. Even many of the witnesses brought forward by the respondent parents that gave glowing testimony, like the former police chief, Donnie Vogler. Thank you. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I'd like to make one very quick point and one point that will take most of my 2 minutes. The very quick point is that my recollection is the testimony of Fred Failia was very clear that he did not provide a copy of the stipulation to Dr. Cotta-George.
Did he testify as to whether or not he had previously worked with Dr. Cotta-George or whether, which side in this dispute picked Dr. Cotta-George?
I do not remember for sure what he testified in that regard at the hearing. Okay. What I'd like to say here is a lot of these arguments make it appear that the parents' rights and the children's rights are at odds. In most cases, in most families, the parents' rights and the children's rights converge and coincide. It's in the best interest of the children to stay with their parents. And what we've seen in this case is a department that, or in any of these cases, the people in the department, the caseworker, the head of the department, have an awesome power over people's lives, over parents' lives, families' lives, children's lives, for good or ill. Sometimes the parents don't do what they're supposed to do, and the department has to step in, as they did initially in this case. But if the department does not exercise their rights correctly, in accordance with due process, and in accordance with trying to reunite the children with their parents, then you have damage to the children caused by the department. And the fact that this department has kept these children out of their homes for so long is part of the damage that's been caused. And these parents should have the right to reunite with their children, and the children should have the right to reunite with their parents. Thank you.
Thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. It is a difficult case. We will take it under advisement. A written opinion will issue in due course.